Ahora hay, con el neoliberalismo ha venido un exacerbado individualismo.
Neoliberalism has brought an exacerbated individualism.
Y nosotros somos de una cultura colectivista.
And we come from a collectivist culture.
No hablo solamente del Perú, hablo de Canadá y de Chile.
I'm not speaking only about Peru, but Canada and Chile.
En todo el continente hemos tenido una organización colectivista.
In the whole continent we have had a collectivist organization.
El avance de la agricultura y ganadería en Europa llevó al esclavismo.
The development of agriculture and cattle raising in Europe led to slavery.
Acá en América han habido dos centros, de los siete centros de los alimentos del mundo, dos están en América. Uno es México y otro son los Andes.
Of the seven centers of food production, two are in America, one is in Mexico, and the other one is in the Andean area.
Eso nos muestra que había una agricultura elevada.
This shows us that we had developed agriculture quite well.
Mis antepasados andinos domesticaron 182 especies.
My Andean ancestors domesticated 182 species.
Entre ellas 3,000 variedades de papas.
Among them 3,000 varieties of potato.
Conocemos las virtudes curativas de 4,500 especies.
We know the medicinal, thank you. We know the medicinal properties of 4,500 different species.
Pero en este continente, el desarrollo de la agricultura no llevó al esclavismo.
But in this continent, developing agriculture did not lead to slavery.
Llevó a otras formas de colectivismo, pero siempre colectivismo.
It led to other kinds of collectivization, but always collectivism.
Eso hemos visto en los aztecas, en los mayas, en los incas.
We've seen that with the Aztecs, Mayan, and Incas.
Se dice que había esclavismo. Supongamos que había esclavismo.
They say there was slavery. Well, let's suppose there was slavery.
Pero era para el servicio doméstico de las castas privilegiadas.
Well, if there were slaves, these slaves were servants of the privileged castes.
Pero la producción no estaba en manos de esclavos en ninguna parte del continente. Eran colectividades las que producían.
But production of goods was not in the hands of slaves in the continent.
Eran colectividades las que producían.
It was collective. It was communities that produced the goods.
En el sur había un estado grande. Había el Tahuantinsuyo, que abarca territorios de seis países actuales latino-sudamericanos.
In the south, we had the Tahuantinsuyo, a region that included what are now six countries in South America.
Bueno, ya no traduzcas esto. Colombia, Perú, Ecuador, Argentina y Chile. Bolivia.
Those are the six countries.
Yeah. Entonces... Los españoles, cuando vinieron al Perú, a la llama le dijeron oveja grande.
The Spanish, when they came to Peru, they called the llama big sheep.
Con esa misma ignorancia, a ese estado grande le dijeron, oh, mira, un imperio.
With that same ignorance to that big state, they called an empire.
Y hasta ahora hay gente que dice que el imperio de los incas.
And up to now, people talk about the Inca Empire.
Pero eso no era un imperio.
But that was not an empire.
Era una colectividad de colectividades.
It was a collective of collectives.
Por supuesto, habían castas superiores. No era el paraíso terrenal.
Of course, there were privileged castes. It wasn't paradise.
Pero no era imperio.
But it was not an empire.
Ese es uno de los pilares básicos. El colectivismo, lo que ahora está haciendo aplastado por el superindividualismo de la sociedad neoliberal.
It is this very important pillar, the collective, that is being crushed by neoliberalism right now.
Que está agrediendo a nuestras comunidades.
Neoliberalism is assaulting our communities.
Esa es una de las razones de la rebelión indígena.
This is one of the reasons why indigenous people rebel.
La otra razón tiene que ver con nuestra cosmovisión.
The other reason has to do with our cosmovision.
Repito, no estoy hablando del Perú, estoy hablando también de Canadá, de Chile, de México, de toda América.
I'm speaking here of all America, not just Peru.
Como hemos escuchado a nuestra hermana, nuestra visión era de la Madre Tierra.
As our sister before me has said, our vision was of Mother Earth.
La palabra Mapuche significa hijo de la tierra.
The word Mapuche means son of the earth or child of the earth.
Nos vinieron con otra visión, con otra cosmovisión los invasores.
The invaders came with a different vision.
Según ellos, Dios, o sea, el creador del mundo era un espíritu que estaba fuera de la tierra.
According to them, God, the creator of the world, was a spirit that was outside the earth.
Que creó al hombre a su imagen y semejanza.
A spirit that created man of his own image and appearance.
Y de una costilla de él a la mujer.
And from one of his ribs, woman.
Y a la naturaleza la creó al servicio del hombre.
And nature, it was created to serve man.
No es solo una visión antropocentrista, sino machismo centrista.
It is not just an anthropocentrist vision, but a male chauvinist one.
Nuestra visión, ya sea en Canadá, en Chile, en el Perú, en México, era que todos éramos hijos de la Madre Tierra.
Our vision, regardless where we were, Canada, Chile, Peru, Mexico, is that we are all children of Mother Earth.
Y que debemos vivir en su seno, en armonía con toda la con todos los otros seres.
And that we must live within it in harmony with all the other living beings.
Con todos los hijos de la Madre Tierra.
With all the children of Mother Earth.
Y la tierra no pertenecía a la gente. Era la gente la que pertenecía a la tierra.
And the land did not belong to the people. It was the people who belonged to the land.
Eso es lo que fue aplastado por los invasores.
That is what was crushed by the invaders.
Que se apoderaron de la tierra.
Who appropriated the land.
Que la usaron a su servicio deteriorándola.
Who used it to serve themselves and who deteriorated it.
Y que el individuo era lo importante.
And for them, the individual was what was important.
El egoísmo, en su forma exacerbada, es lo que ahora domina.
Selfishness, to its major degree, is what is now ruling.
La esencia de nuestra cultura es la solidaridad.
The essence of our culture is solidarity.
No solo entre los seres humanos, sino con todos los hijos de la Madre Tierra.
Not only among human beings, but with the children, all the children of Mother Earth.
Por eso es que ahora se levanta el movimiento indígena.
This is why the Andean movement is now on the rise.
Acerca del socialismo quiero hablar algo.
I want to say something about socialism.
Es una anécdota que siempre relato de mi... Tengo una hija que llevó turistas suecos a una comunidad indígena.
I always like to tell this anecdote. I have a daughter who took some Swedish tourists to an indigenous community in Peru.
Para que viviera unos días ahí.
So that the tourists may live there for 3 days.
Ellos le dijeron a mi hija, esto se parece al socialismo.
And the tourists told my daughter, this looks like socialism.
Mi hija le dijo, no es así, es el socialismo lo que se parece a esto.
And my daughter told them, that's not right, it's socialism that looks like this.
Porque esto había 10,000 años antes de que naciera la abuelita Carlos Marx.
Because this existed 10,000 years before Karl Marx's grandmother was born.
Y Eduardo Galeano, un escritor latinoamericano, cuenta que Tomás Moro, el autor de la novela Utopía, conversó con marineros que fueron de esta parte del planeta.
And Eduardo Galeano tells us that Thomas More, who wrote Utopia, was inspired from what sailors who traveled to this part of the planet told him.
Basado en eso, escribió su novela Utopía.
And he based his novel Utopia on those stories.
Después vinieron los socialistas utópicos y después vino Marx.
And after that came utopian socialists and Marx.
Ahora, les pido a ustedes que, voy a hablar de las agresiones que ahora estamos sufriendo en el Perú y en otros países.
Now I want to talk about the aggressions that we are suffering in Peru and other countries.
Las minas están envenenando el agua.
Mining companies are poisoning the water.
Están envenenando los pastos, están envenenando a la gente, están envenenando los animales, están envenenando la tierra.
They're poisoning the grass, the people, the animals, they're poisoning the land.
Están privatizando todo.
They're privatizing everything.
Entonces, eso es lo que sentimos como agresión.
This is what we mean by aggression.
Sabemos que no estamos solos, que también eso agrede al resto de la humanidad.
We know that we're not alone. We know that the same aggressors are attacking the rest of humanity.
Pero los que más sentimos somos los indígenas, porque están atacando los pilares fundamentales de nuestra cultura.
But the ones who feel it the worst are indigenous people because they're attacking the pillars of our culture.
Por eso les pido a ustedes que respeten y se solidaricen con el movimiento indígena canadiense.
Because that's why I would like to ask you, beg you to respect and show solidarity with the indigenous movement in Canada.
Porque son los más agredidos por el sistema y que por lo tanto luchan contra este sistema.
Because they are the ones who are harmed the worst by this system and are trying to fight it.
Probablemente ellos se espanten de la palabra socialismo o de la palabra ecología.
They may become afraid of the word socialism or the word ecology.
También pasa eso en el Perú.
Same happens in Peru.
Pero cuando se escucha hablar de esos temas en sus términos, entonces vemos que a qué se refieren.
But when they hear the same discussions articulated in their own terms, then they approve of them.
Y no vamos a ir pues a ellos llevándoles los términos nuestros, o sea, los términos de ustedes, sino escuchar qué términos usan ellos y hablarles en sus términos.
And we are not going to go to them taking our own terms. We have to listen to the terms that they use and then explain things in those terms.
Pensamos que, en estos días va a haber una reunión en México convocada por los indígenas mexicanos, entre ellos los zapatistas, que a donde van a ir nuestros hermanos indígenas canadienses.
These days, shortly, there will be a meeting called by our sisters and brothers, the zapatistas, and to this meeting, our Canadian indigenous nations are going to be sending delegates.
Esa reunión es muy importante.
That is a very important meeting.
Les pido a ustedes que se enteren de los acuerdos de esa reunión, que no está apoyada por ninguna ONG.
I ask you to become acquainted with what is decided at this meeting. It's a meeting that is not supported or financed by NGO, by any NGO.
Entonces, no sé qué acuerdos van a tomar, pero a ustedes les pido que vean con mucha atención los acuerdos que se van a tomar en esa reunión.
I don't know what decisions will be made, but I ask you to follow up on those.
Los indígenas de todos los países nos sentimos solidarios entre nosotros.
Indigenous peoples of all countries feel solidarity among each other.
En Montreal estuve cuando los indígenas manifestaron exigiendo que Canadá cambie su posición en contra de esa declaración indígena a las Naciones Unidas.
In Montreal, I was there when indigenous people asked the Canadian government to change its position on the... ¿Qué declaración?
De la declaración de los derechos indígenas de las Naciones Unidas.
Oh, the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous Rights.
Fueron cuatro los países que votaron en contra.
Four countries voted against it.
Estados Unidos, Canadá, Israel y Australia, creo.
United States, Canada, Israel and Australia, I believe.
Pero fue aprobado.
But it passed.
Claro que es muy limitada, pero ya es algo.
It's a very limited resolution, but it's something.
Es algo así como el acuerdo de Kioto para la ecología.
It's something like the Kyoto Protocol vis-a-vis ecology.
Esto es lo que presenté en la reunión de LASA a la que fui invitado acá en Canadá.
This is what this is the text of my speech at the LASA meeting in Canada.
He titulado Pasado Futuro.
I entitled it Past Future.
Porque pensamos construir nuestro futuro, que es decir, no queremos volver al pasado.
Because we don't want to go back to the past.
Pensamos ir al futuro.
We hope to go to the future.
Pero vamos a construir ese futuro basado en nuestras raíces culturales.
But we are going to build that future based on our cultural roots.
Que se puede resumir en dos aspectos.
Which can be summarized in two respects.
El respeto a la madre tierra.
The respect to the mother earth.
Y que la principal actividad sea relacionada con ese respeto.
And that the main activity be related to that respect.
Y la vuelta al colectivismo.
And the return to collectivism.
Esas son las dos raíces culturales de la población indígena y a eso queremos encaminarnos.
Those are the two cultural roots of indigenous peoples and that's where we want to go.
Como digo, sabemos que no estamos solos.
As I said before, we know we're not alone.
Puesto que toda la sociedad se ve agredida por el neoliberalismo.
Because the whole of society is attacked by neoliberalism.
Entonces, caminemos todos juntos en búsqueda del retorno a esas dos raíces de nuestra cultura.
Therefore, we must all walk together in search of the return to that culture.
Eso es todo.
That's it.
You have just heard a speech by the Peruvian indigenous activist Hugo Blanco. He spoke at Simon Fraser University in downtown Vancouver on September 21, 2007. Now we add two responses to audience questions. First, Hugo is asked about community resistance to environmental oppression, in this case, by a Canadian mining company.
El día 16 de este mes hubo una consulta popular en Cajamarca, un plebiscito para ver si la gente estaba de acuerdo con la instalación de una mina o no.
On September 16th, there was a plebiscite in Cajamarca, a province in Peru, to see whether people agreed with el establecimiento de people agreed with the government allowing a mining corporation to operate.
El gobierno dijo que ese plebiscito era ilegal y que era un delito.
The government said that the plebiscite was illegal and it should be punished.
La mina ofreció darles dar mucho dinero a la gente.
The mining corporation promised people a lot of money.
Pero el 90% de la gente dijo agricultura sí, mina no.
But 90% of the people said agriculture yes, mine no.
Y ahí estaba el movimiento indígena y también estaba mucha gente no indígena.
And many people fought this struggle. There were indigenous, many of them, but there were also non-indigenous peoples.
Hace algunos años, la Manhattan, una compañía canadiense, quería sacar el oro de una población peruana, que es, bueno, Tambo Grande.
Some years ago, a Canadian corporation, the Manhattan Corporation, wanted to extract gold from subfloor in a town called Tambo Grande.
Hubo un agrónomo que explicó a la gente el daño que haría eso y la empresa hizo que mataran al agrónomo.
An agronomist explained the harm that would do to the land and the people, and the corporation had the agronomist killed.
Por supuesto, el gobierno cumple su función de sirviente de las empresas multinacionales y el gobierno apoyaba a la empresa.
Of course, the government, a servant of multinational corporations, supported the mining company.
Pero la gente se rebeló.
But people rebelled.
Indígenas y no indígenas.
Indigenous and non-indigenous people.
La compañía esa hacía propaganda acá en Canadá diciendo que los indígenas eran unos envidiosos porque la mina iba a ser explotada en un lugar desértico.
The corporation was popularizing here in Canada the notion that the Indians over there were ignorant and selfish because what the company was trying to do was trying to make something out of a desert.
La población luchó valientemente contra la mina.
The population fought courageously against the mining corporation.
Hubo solidaridad en Lima de sectores no indígenas.
There was solidarity in Lima from non-indigenous people.
Y los ecologistas canadienses, que parece que algo conocen a las multinacionales de acá y su amor por la verdad, fueron al Perú y fueron a Tambo Grande.
Canadian ecologists who seem to know something about multinational corporations and have a certain love for the truth traveled to Peru, to Tambo Grande.
Sacaron fotografías de ese valle agrícolamente muy rico.
They took pictures of that valley, which is very rich in plants of all sorts.
Y invitaron a que venga acá un habitante de Tambo Grande a explicar cuál era su lucha.
And they brought a resident of Tambo Grande here to Canada to explain why they were fighting the mining company.
Y el salón donde iba a explicar estaba bordeado de las fotografías de lo que era Tambo Grande.
And the hall where the guest spoke was, the walls were papered with the photographs of what Tambo Grande really was.
Esa es la ligazón que existe entre el movimiento indígena y la gente no indígena, inclusive del Canadá.
That is the kind of link that exists between indigenous people and non-indigenous people, even in Canada.
En otro aspecto, en la democratización de la sociedad.
In the fight to democratize society.
Hay un municipio indígena donde son las comunidades las que deciden qué obra se va a hacer y no es el alcalde.
There is an indigenous municipality where it is the communities who decide what is to be done, and it's not the mayor.
Eso comenzó a extenderse en la población no indígena y por eso el gobierno se ha visto obligado a legislar algo suave, pero en ese sentido.
That practice, the indigenous community practice, began to expand to places where there were not indigenous communities, and the government has had to legislate something of that sort to apply to the rest of the country.
Creo que basta para ejemplos.
I think it's enough of examples. Enough examples.
Pido disculpas que no concluí bien porque la lucha en el Perú contra la Manhattan, la compañía canadiense, triunfó y se tuvo que retirarse la compañía.
I have to apologize because I didn't tell you that at the end of the struggle was successful in Tambo Grande in Peru and the mining company had to go away.
As the evening was organized to discuss eco-socialism, Hugo offered a comparison between indigenous action in South America and the enlightened green Marxism being proposed by his co-panelist, author Joel Covell.
Creo que hablamos de la... creo que no hay discrepancia entre nosotros.
I don't think there are differences between us.
Yo hablo en el idioma indígena y él habla en el idioma marxista, pero no hay discrepancia, decimos lo mismo.
I speak in the indigenous language and he speaks in Marxist terms, but we are saying the same.
Pero yo creo que debemos tratar de hablar en otro lenguaje a los canadienses que tal vez no entienden ninguno de estos dos idiomas.
But I think we could probably speak in a different language to Canadians who don't know either of the languages we're using.
Califican al movimiento. Hay mucha gente que califica al movimiento indígena de divisionista, de racista, etc.
Many people think of the indigenous movement as a racist or a divisive one.
Pero no es así. Nosotros queremos que se nos reconozca, que se nos respete como indígenas, pero nos sentimos hermanos de toda la humanidad.
But that's not true. We want to be recognized as indigenous and as people, but we exist in solidarity with the rest of humanity.
Y esto no son palabras solamente, son hechos. Recordemos que la primera reunión mundial contra el neoliberalismo y por la humanidad fue llamado por los indígenas de Chiapas y se realizó en el campo chiapaneco mucho antes que los foros sociales mundiales.
And this is not just words, this is facts. Let's remember that the first international gathering against neoliberalism was called by the Zapatistas and it took place in Chiapas.
Por los indígenas, fue llamado por los indígenas de Chiapas.
It was called by the Chiapas indigenous people.
Bueno, por último, hay novedades con respecto a lo que dijeron los clásicos del marxismo.
There are news with respect to what the Marxist classics said.
Trotsky y Rosa Luxemburgo dijeron socialismo o barbarie.
Trotsky and Rosa Luxemburg said socialism or barbarism.
Pero ahora creo que la alternativa no es socialismo o barbarie.
But I think that today the alternative is not socialism or barbarism.
Socialismo o destrucción de la especie humana y de muchas especies inocentes que no han participado en la destrucción de la humanidad ni de las especies ni de la vida.
The alternative is socialism or the destruction of human beings of many other species, innocent species who have not participated in creating the debacle.
Es todo.
Hugo Blanco, Peruvian indigenous activist, speaking last month on a forum on eco-socialism put on by Seven Oaks Magazine at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, BC. Thanks to Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock for that recording. You can find more of his work at ecoshock.org, and you can check out Seven Oaks, a magazine of politics, culture, and resistance at 7OaksMag.com. Now that you've heard how absurd our system of money is, and of the ill effects that result from it, perhaps you won't find what I'm going to read for you next as far-fetched as you might have. This week, I'm going to begin reading from a book titled For Giving by Genevieve Vaughn that advocates not the reform of money, but its abolition, along with the paradigm of commodification that underlies it. Genevieve Vaughn will be familiar to long-time listeners. I've played presentations from a conference on the gift economy that she organized a few years ago. Ugo Blanco spoke of an old system of social relations, and Vaughn's idea of the uncommodified life is even older. Vestiges still exist as the basis of some of our most important relationships. The idea of money and markets are a relatively recent development in human history. Advocates of the market economy like to say that capitalism, free markets, and even the laws of intellectual property spur human innovation. I don't think that's true. Innovation is part of our nature. It is what we are. As long as we have been human, we have innovated when in need. Consider these inventions that arose long before the existence of money and markets. The domestication of fire, the invention of agriculture, architecture, metallurgy, weaving, tanning, cooking, the wheel, sailing and boat building, medicines, navigation, music, language, and art. Much of our modern technology are refinements of these basic inventions. I personally believe in the gift economy and have practiced it all my life. This show was an example. I don't receive a penny for doing it. In fact, with one exception, I have never been paid to do the work I want to do or that I feel must be done. And conversely, in order to be paid, I have done work that I did not want to do and did not think was useful. I judge the work I was not paid to do to have been more beneficial to society than the work I was paid to do. Furthermore, the useless or harmful work I was paid to do robbed me of time and energy to make beneficial and beautiful creations in the world, as well as oftentimes, it robbed me of my human dignity. As was made clear in Money as Debt, a small group of people who control the money have as a result the power to control what work is done by whom and how. The result is that important things that need doing aren't done because they would not profit these men, and the production of harmful and useless things commands a large share of humanity's labors. A clear example of this can be seen in the urban slum. It is an area where people with little money live in buildings that someone else owns, because the people who live there have no money to own the buildings themselves. Because the place is dilapidated, rents are lower than elsewhere. Landlords have no incentive to fix the buildings because of the low rents. Tenants have no incentive to fix the buildings, even if they could muster the money for materials and donate their labor. Were they to fix up the area, they would be evicted, as the buildings could now attract tenants with more money to pay the landlords. The people are poor because they must work at low-paying jobs or perhaps can't find jobs at all. Improving our education, one of the platitudes put forth by politicians, won't help, because the economy is structured in a way that the majority of the jobs pay poorly in order that the employers can make a profit. An individual who gets an education may be able to escape poverty, but her place will be taken by another. Only an education that leads to a general overthrow of this system will materially change anyone's conditions. To the extent that whole nations become prosperous, the slums that underlie that prosperity upon which it is based are brought into existence in another nation. Because they are too far away to be seen, people believe that their prosperity has eliminated poverty, when in fact it has just transferred it elsewhere. Vaughn begins her book with a lengthy introduction in which we learn something about her life and the intellectual influences that led to the development of her ideas. I will begin there. Genevieve Vaughn writes, I have been very fortunate in the things my life has brought me to do. For example, in 1963, I married an Italian philosophy professor and moved to Italy, where I was able to participate in a number of intellectual currents. In 1964, a group of professors in Bologna who wanted to start a new philosophical journal asked my husband to help them apply Marx's analysis of the commodity and money to language. The problem and the way they stated it were fascinating to me. I began to think about it then, and in fact have never stopped. Although the journal did not happen after all, my ex-husband did write about the relations between language and exchange. I did not agree with him, but it took many years before I was able to understand why. Finally, in 1975-76, I stayed for a couple of years in the United States and was able to devote myself to thinking the problem through. In 1977-78, I wrote a couple of academic essays which were published in the early 80s. They are cited in the bibliography, and I invite readers who are academically inclined to read them. I was able to go into some issues more thoroughly than I have in this book. For instance, in an essay titled Saussure and Vygotsky via Marx, I discuss Saussure's concept of linguistic value regarding the analogy he makes with exchange, correcting for the differences Marx would see in his idea of exchange value. In Communication and Exchange, I introduce the idea of communicative need, identify exchange as aberrant communication, and analyze money as a one-word language. In 1978, I got a divorce and began going to a feminist consciousness-raising group. Many of the women in the group worked at the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, which was located near my house in Rome. Women came from many places to talk about issues ranging from the protests at Greenham Commons to jelly babies caused by radioactivity in the Pacific Islands. Issues of women and development were also at the forefront in the group. Many of the women in our group went to the UN Decade for Women conference in Copenhagen and told the rest of us all about it when they came back. There was a lot of interesting philosophical discussion going on in the Italian feminist movement at the time. I participated in some courses at the Virginia Woolf Cultural Center, an independent women's university in Rome, started by feminist philosopher Alessandra Bocchetti. It was during that time that I began to realize that women's free labor in the home was the great unseen element that could be the basis of a new philosophy. I had been doing a lot of gift-giving in my own life, both bringing up my daughters and as a wife. I began to see that my values and those of most women differed from the values and priorities of most of the men I had met, whether academics or bureaucrats, laborers or activists. It occurred to me that women's free labor could be understood as the economic base for an alternative superstructure, a system of ideas and values different from prevailing patriarchal ideas and values. In 1983, I came back to the U.S. to try to put gift-giving values into practice in contexts outside the home. The last chapter of this book discusses that attempt, which is still ongoing. This practice, which was somewhat specific in my personal situation, did not leave much time for theoretical work. Gift-giving can be very time-consuming, which is what happens also in mothering. I was involved in many women's organizations and discussed the idea of the gift economy with everyone, trying to normalize it. One of the people I discussed it with was Sonia Johnson, who used it, citing me in her book, Wildfire. I think her treatment was caught in the contradictions between ego and other and could not lead to the kind of social change for all that I think is necessary. I think I finally began working on the present book in about 1988, though certainly not full-time, without the advantages and disadvantages of academia. It became very long, then short again. The file in my computer under which this version is kept is Short Book. I have tried to integrate most of the ideas into the text and footnotes, but many had to be left aside. During the time in which I was living in Italy, we felt the wind blowing from France, where many thinkers were dealing with issues of communications, economics, semiotics, and psychoanalysis. The school of Jacques Lacan had broken new ground, and anthropologists like Claude Lévi-Strauss and Maurice Gaudelier had broadened the investigations started by Marcel Mauss and Émile Durkheim. Georges Bataille, Michel Foucault, and Jacques Derrida investigated language, culture, and the unconscious. For me, the most interesting of all these thinkers was Jean-Joseph Gou, whose application of Marx's analysis of the commodity and money to various social structures led in directions which were different from mine, among other reasons, because my reading of Marx was different. The feminist thinkers Luce Ingarray and Julia Kristeva had a difficult patriarchal context in which to operate and sometimes came to Italy to find support among the Italian women philosophers. The Semiotics Summer Institute at Urbino was a place of fine intellectual ferment, where many of the French and Italian semioticians and at that time anti-postmodernists, as well as a few from the U.S. and Eastern Europe, gathered to present their theories to the faithful. I heard Jean Baudrillard and Jean-François Lyotard there, as well as Umberto Eco, Massimo Bonifanti, Augusto Ponzio, Luis Prieto, my ex-husband Ferruccio Rossi Landi, and many others. I wrote a paper on nurturing and communication for the last summer institute I attended. But since I neglected to go through the bureaucratic channels to get on the list, I presented it only to a small group who got together for the purpose. I also belong to the Centro Romano de Semiotica and attended many presentations by local and international speakers. When I moved back to the U.S. in 1983, I encountered Lewis Hyde's book, The Gift, Imagination and the Erotic Life of Property. While it was heartening to see gift-giving described with honor, I thought that the lack of a theory of language as gift-giving limited the scope of the book to literary criticism, which anyway lingered too long on Ezra Pound's anti-Semitic ravings. I had already read Malinowski's Argonauts of the Western Pacific in college, and later Marcel Mauss's essay on the gift. I read in these books about the potlatch practiced by Native American tribes of the Pacific Northwest, and since then I have discussed these giveaways not only with anthropologists, but with the people for whom they are a living, traditional economic way. Then books like Jean Baker Miller's Toward a New Psychology of Women, Nancy Chodorow's The Reproduction of Mothering, Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice, and later Sarah Ruddick's Maternal Thinking showed me how women in the U.S. were dealing with their difference from patriarchy. Already in Italy, there had been a wide movement among feminists dealing with sexual difference in a positive way. The postmodern criticism of phallogocentrism brings up many important issues. However, I believe that the recognition of the fundamental importance of gift-giving cannot be the antidote to phallogocentrism on the reality plane, with important repercussions on the psychological and verbal planes. I hope also that my use of the model of Vygotsky's experiment in concept formation can clarify how patriarchy comes to be, how men are logified and women are reified. The advantage of Vygotsky's model is that it presents concept formation as a dynamic process with stages, and it is not a static picture of similarities and differences. It transfers to the plane of cognitive psychology an issue that has been important for philosophy from Aristotle's One Many Problem to Derrida's questions about exemplarity. I look at this problem as a symptom of centuries of patriarchal misconceptions. Vygotsky believed that children were only able to form concepts at puberty. If the concept structure riddles society as I propose, then it alters the context into which children of both genders are born, making it hard for children to understand their own cognitive processes, at least until they are acting them out at another level, at puberty. This consideration brings me to a theory of knowledge that I will just mention, which I call Nel blu dipinto di blu, in the blue, painted blue, from the song Volare by Domenica Modugno. I believe that when we are doing something in our own lives, we are more likely to see similar things in the world around us. For example, it was during the rise of survival of the fittest capitalism that survival of the fittest evolutionary theory developed. By this, I do not mean to imply that what is seen is not true, but only that it might not have been seen at all if people had not been acting in a similar way at a different level. Perhaps it is because men have been embodying the one-many relation in their lives and projecting it into society that it has been important in philosophy. Vygotsky would have been no more exempt from this than anyone else. Moreover, for various reasons connected with the practice of exchange, which I discuss in this book, we are also not recognizing the gift-giving many of us are already doing. I hope that this book will allow women and men not only to practice more gift-giving, but to see that they are already doing a great deal of it, to recognize that they are already painted blue, and to see the blue of the sky that surrounds them. I believe that much of the anti-authoritarianism of both women and men can be understood as an appropriate anti-patriarchal attitude. The desire to place heart over head or emotion above reason is a kind of translation of the need to put the gift paradigm above the exchange paradigm. We should do this not just for sentimental reasons, which also have to do with gift-giving, but for practical reasons, which have to do with the survival of life on the planet. I have written For Giving in order to understand patriarchy so that we, women and men, can make the deep and far-reaching changes that are necessary. As I was writing the book, at a certain point I was wondering whether I would be accused of penis envy and a castrating attitude. As the goddess would have it, however, just at that moment, I received a call from a friend in Germany about the women in former Yugoslavia, and a call from a friend here who was the child of a rape and who was working on that issue. 18,000 babies from the rapes in Bosnia, they said, many of them abandoned. What horror stories! After I hung up and began to write again, I wept and screamed in sorrow, frustration, and rage. They said that the men had sometimes been forced to rape to continue in the army. Mothers were raped and killed in front of their daughters, who were also raped. Babies were cut out of their mothers' wombs and dog fetuses put in their place. We could say this is only former Yugoslavia and put it in a context that doesn't belong to the U.S. But I have heard many similar stories from around the world. And in 1991, when the U.S. began the war against Iraq, we received information that men in the U.S. Marine boot camps sang the refrain, "Rape the women, kill the children, it's the only thing to do." I'm sorry, my brothers. Those of you who would desert and risk death to avoid this, perhaps it does not apply to you. I hope for all our sake it does not. But do you realize how much pain and unspeakable horror this high of yours or theirs is causing? Let the men who read this learn to give by giving me the leeway to go ahead and try to tell it like it is. If you discount me, you are enabling that behavior. And the same to you mothers who want to protect your sons from a blow to their self-esteem. Protect your sons not from me, from the truth, but from the society which turns them into ghouls and vampires, their instrument of love into an instrument of hate. Protect them from the phallic images and resonators that radiate validation to them from the society at large, that cause you to think that I am being, quote, unrealistic, and that let you allow them to go ahead and join the army or become arms manufacturers or exploitative capitalists. All rapists and torturers had mothers. What can I say? That I'm sorry that I see this clearly? I'm sorry for us all. But if we see it, we can stop it. Anything we can do to change the situation is worth consideration. Please read this book, knowing that is its intention. I ask forgiveness for the long time it has taken me to bring these ideas to light. I tried to do it sooner, but did not succeed. I ask forgiveness also for the many inadequacies and inaccuracies that may be found in this book. In my defense, I can only offer the consideration that once you stop taking the purveyors of the dominant paradigm seriously, it's hard to remember exactly what they say. I ask forgiveness of friends who may be surprised at my ideas. A paradigm hangs together and needs to be explained all at once. Though I have expressed my opinions, I have often found a lack of comprehension because the wider context of the opinions was invisible. For that reason, I did not always try to expose my point of view, though I did try to practice it. If my anti-patriarchal analysis makes you uncomfortable, dear reader, I want to make it clear that I believe all life is sacred and miraculous, and that means your life, too. The problem is a logic and a system, a self-confirming paradigm of dominance and a dominant paradigm, not the individual male or female person. Listen to William Blake's explanation from the poem London in Songs of Experience. In the cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mind-forged manacles I hear. I believe the manacles to be forged not just in the mind, but through a feedback loop on the material plane also. Perhaps we cannot break the manacles because that would require the violence that confirms patriarchal domination. However, we can unlock them. In this book, I try to find a key so small it fits into the mind. Please use it. Genevieve Vaughn ends her introduction section with these quotes. The first from Karl Marx, quote, "Language is as old as consciousness. Language is practical consciousness that exists also for other men. And for that reason alone, it really exists personally for me as well." And this, from La Folie Percival, 1330 AD, the question, "Whom does the Grail serve?" And that was the introduction of Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. Let's continue then with chapter one titled Where to Start. Vaughn writes, "Capitalism and communism are both patriarchal. The philosophy of social change, which is wider and deeper than either of them, is feminism. I believe that feminism is a collective philosophy, a body of thought and action based on the values of women worldwide, which is presently revealing itself to the consciousness of all. Patriarchy has infected women and men for centuries, distorting our view of the world and warping our socio-economic practices. The agenda of feminism is to liberate everyone, women, children, and men, from patriarchy without destroying the human beings who are its carriers and the planet where they live. Trying to think outside of patriarchy puts women in a situation similar to that of the ancient pre-Socratic philosophers who were thinking at the beginning of Western patriarchal culture. If we reject the patterns of thought that have riddled and plagued European culture, there is a great deal of untrodden ground before us. We need to reconnect with our innocence, with the hearts that have not made war, that have moved us to take care of children and old people in spite of great difficulties, rather than abuse them. We need to reject the patriarchal worldview and start over, naively looking through our own eyes. When we stop believing what we've been told, we find that the truth is there, but our ability to recognize it has been numbed and buried deep within by the strata of the history of individuals, of cultures, and of the species. It is the reawakened, collectively formulated women's perspective that proves the human species was not Mother Nature's mistake. By adopting it, women and the men who follow them can reverse the destruction of human beings and the planet. In order to reject patriarchal thinking, we must be able to distinguish between it and something else, an alternative. The disciplines of academia have a tendency to mushroom into worlds to which thousands of international researchers and thinkers contribute. In spite of many advances, they validate a view of the world and a reality in which the perpetration of abuse and domination is endemic at many levels. I believe that there is a relatively simple fatal flaw which undermines all so-called first-world thinking, including the thinking of the academic worlds. We usually begin our investigations into different subjects downstream from this flaw, and therefore we are already under its influence. The naive point of view allows us to begin at the beginning. Usually, academics build upon the past and begin at a place so far down the course of the river that the flaw can no longer be identified. Indeed, it seems to constitute reality. It is at the beginning that we can hope to find the alternative. Because of the circumstances of my life, I have been able to turn my own naive attention towards one area of academic concern, which has been particularly important in the 20th century, the study of language and other sign systems. Whatever their other achievements, the disciplines of linguistics and semiotics and the philosophy of language have brought forward the fundamental importance of language for the human character and condition. If language is important, it follows that the study of language in the disciplines of linguistics and semiotics is a good place to begin an investigation of patriarchal thinking. Communication by means of language is now considered by academics to be a separate and independent rule-governed activity. Some linguists believe that the fact that all human communities use language is evidence that language is transmitted, for the most part, not culturally but genetically. Syntactic rules and sometimes even elements of vocabulary appear to be part of the hardware handed down from generation to generation. It seems to me that such genetic endowments would predetermine our linguistic behavior in a biology is destiny sort of way. In this, language would appear similar to gender, the characteristics of which were for centuries culturally considered to be biologically transmitted and therefore unchangeable and unchallengeable, especially by the, quote, genetically inferior gender. Making language a gift given by our DNA, not a cultural inheritance, locates it in an area which is beyond human intervention. If we believe instead that language is a social endowment which must be learned by flexible young mind-body complexes in the making, our idea of the human character varies accordingly. What is learned can be subjected to collective revision. Its mechanisms can be investigated by the learners, its consequences altered. Strange as they seem to me, considerations such as the genetic transmission of language are taken seriously and have far-reaching ripple effects for other disciplines. An environment is created in which some ideas fit together and thrive because they are validated as permissible and respectable, while their alternatives are discredited. The so-called free market of ideas, like the economic free market, often promotes the benefit of a genetically superior few, quote-unquote, while appearing to be good for everyone. And I've been reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange, by Genevieve Vaughn, published in 1997. And this book is, of course, available free of charge. Can be downloaded on the web at 4-giving.com. www.thegiftecom, which will also take you to more links on the gift economy.